while identifying the objects that are in view is a really important problem that has contributed like tremendously to our understanding of processing in the ventral stream, I think that it has happened at the expense of appreciating that that's not just what your form processing pathway is for. You might want to take even a step further back and ask yourself, well, what do we do with that amazing ability to remember images? And there, I think machine learning has some really interesting things to say that build on some observations that I think are classic observations.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey, everyone. I'm Paul Middlebrooks. Welcome to Brain Inspired. One of the great success stories connecting neuroscience and AI is how well some deep neural networks match brain activity. In particular, convolutional neural networks can be arranged in layers and made to mimic the cascade of brain regions associated with processing visual images, from low-level features like edges and contrast up to entire objects like hot dogs and elephants. But identifying objects isn't particularly useful in itself. It's useful in context. What can we do with an object? Can we eat it? And so on. One particularly useful thing to do is to remember what we've seen. And we're extremely good at remembering what we see. So good that if we're exposed to 10,000 images for just a second or so each, we can later pick out those seen images among ones we haven't seen before. My guest today, Nicole Rust, studies visual memory, and we talk all about her work showing that the same populations of neurons in our visual cortex that can represent objects and images can also represent how memorable and how novel those objects and images are. More than that, those convolutional neural networks that represent objects similar to the way visual cortex represents objects, they also appear to represent memorability similar to how visual cortex does, even when the deep networks aren't even trained to predict memorability. This train of work has led Nicole to also start thinking about how a system could use novelty to drive its curiosity and exploration to learn most efficiently. And she sees a way forward to combine what we know about how brains do this with how AI has done this using reinforcement learning to better understand how we use visual memory and novelty to help us learn. You can find out more about Nicole by following her on Twitter at Visual Memory Lab. And I link to that and her website and things that we discuss in the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/57. If you follow the podcast, you know I'm building an online course to explore the entire neuroscience and AI landscape. I just posted a little introduction video that I made that explains more what to expect from the course. If you're interested, you can learn more at braininspired.co/course. Which reminds me, if you're a Patreon supporter, like recent supporters Charlie, Travis, and Chomsky Balls. Did you enter your name as Chomsky Balls just so I'd say Chomsky Balls on the podcast? Anyway, thanks, Patreon supporters. If you are a Patreon supporter, you will have that video in your email box, so check your emails. Happy New Year, everyone. If you're like me, the new year means essentially nothing. But either way, a great way to start the new year, or any day, really, is learning from Nicole Rust. So I'm walking into my front door of my childhood home, and there's this giant squid hanging in my way, drying and wilting in the harsh heat of the sun. I get through and I turn right, and in the corner of the entryway, I see my third cousin, the one with all the herpes breakouts, performing a lewd act on a hamburger. Right next to her is the fish tank that's filled with Jell-O and this crying roly-poly, and this is how I remember my wife's phone number. Nicole, welcome and thanks for being here. How do you remember your social security number?
Well, thanks so much for having me, Paul. Yes, that was a great example of the method of loci, right? The highly visual imagery with which that can help us remember hard things. Yeah, wonderful example.
Yeah. Well, so that method, also called the memory palace, I guess, technique, uses visual imagery, which is easy to remember, to help people remember things that are harder to remember, like sequences of numbers. So a real story, my actual cousin, when she was young, I asked her, you know, what her first memory was. And she told me she remembered being born. And the way she described it was, you know, there's this light and then there's this pink stuff all around. And she goes toward the light and then she's born and she sees all this stuff. And what's striking about that, besides that, I think she watched the movie Look Who's Talking and took her memory from that, which is dates me, I guess. But
yes, I'm with you. Yeah.
What's striking is the all of her memory has to do with what she saw. It's not the smell or the sounds and things. Do you have an earliest memory?
Oh goodness, I do have an earliest memory of kind of running away from home when I was 2 years old, and I can remember. I think I just got lost.
Two.
Yeah. Visually, I do remember the color of the truck and what the woman looked like who picked me up and brought me home. And my mother was hysterical, but I remember it was a brown truck. Yeah. So I have this very salient visual imagery of that wandering away. Yeah.
It's visual, but man, too, that is impressive. I think my memory is really poor. I don't have memories from that young. I don't know that many people do.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful unsolved mystery about what happens, because children can remember things when they're children,
yeah.
Right? And then those memories seem to get overwritten. It's a fascinating question that we still don't understand.
Gosh, I guess your synapse is never pruned as you were growing, but you know,
that would explain a lot.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about visual memory here. So you have recently applied what you've learned about how brains recognize objects to how those same neurons and brains could basically be used to remember the objects. So I'll just ask you to start off, what is visual recognition memory and what about it interests you?
Yeah, so what is recognition memory? I mean, the thing that interests me, starting with that question,
sure,
is I'm really compelled by the remarkable ability to remember the images that we've seen. So a classic example, we can take you or any of your listeners and we can have them flip through a big stack of photographs. So, for example, you know, thousands and thousands of images, and we can ask them to look at each one of those images. It would take them hours or maybe several days to look at all those images. And then we can test their memory. And what we find is that subjects are remarkable at remembering images. So, for example, if you took photographs from the stack and you paired them with photographs that they haven't seen and you gave them a memory test, just ask them, which one did you see? Subjects will perform on average over 90% correct on that task. So memory is this remarkable form of learning and happens on single trials. It happens with vast capacity. And so that's really what motivates me to study this, is just our remarkable ability to remember images coupled with the fact that we have very little idea how our brains manage to support that type of memory. So
yes,
that's what we're trying to figure out. Yeah.
So the task that you just described is kind of the same, you know, that task is used in studies of this kind of visual recognition memory.
Yes.
One could potentially perform that, look through all those, you know, let's say 10,000, if we go back to the 1970s study, you know, they look through 10,000, which is just a monstrous thing to have people do in the first place. But it was done. And it's been scaled back these days, but still a lot of time and effort is required to perform these studies, I know.
Yes.
But I can imagine someone performing this task where, you know, you're shown two pictures, one of which you have seen, one which you have not seen. And I wouldn't need to necessarily exactly remember the picture to guess that that's the one that I've seen. I just would have, I could have some sense of familiarity with it. And I know that there's this difference between familiarity and recollection memory in recognition memory. So what is that difference? I mean, you know, and do we know what underlies it?
Yeah. So there are two questions that we might want to talk about. So what is familiarity? So I like to describe that experience that I think we've all had. So you're walking down the street and you see someone and you say, oh, I know that person. And sometimes you can have that experience absent any details, any ability to recall who they are or how you know them. You just can have that. You just have that sense of remembering, that percept that they're familiar. Mm-hmm. So that's familiarity, the sense of remembering absent details. And then sometimes what happens is a few moments later, you get this wave of details that come back to you. So who they are, how you know them, where you met them. That's recollection. So that's the difference between familiarity and recollection.
Are they both grouped under episodic memory or declarative memory, I suppose?
Yes. I mean, So the field has decades of very hot debate about whether or not familiarity and recollection are two memory systems or one, whether they're supported by two different brain structures or the same brain structure. Is familiarity a weak form of recollection? I think that there's some pretty strong evidence at this point to suggest that our ability to remember the images that we've seen is supported by stuff that's going on in high-level visual parts of our brain, in addition to a specialized structure called perirhinal cortex. Mm-hmm. And that's a distinct memory system from what's happening in, say, the hippocampus that's supporting recollection.
Ah, right. Well, let's get into this memory in the brain and with objects. So the rate code is an idea. It's an old idea of how neurons encode information. It's old, yes. Like I said. So it's, you know, essentially the idea that neuron spiking rate increases with as you stimulate it more, with increasing stimulation. And this goes back to Edgar Adrian, the first single neuron recordings, right? And he was hanging weights from frog leg muscles that had been, you know, prepared. And the more weight he hung, the higher the firing rate of the neurons were, essentially. And we've been using that as the rate code to understand how processes get encoded in neurons ever since. But the new thing, I say new, it's now sort of decades old, I guess, is population codes, that things can be represented as distinct patterns of neuron firing rates within the population, right? So you studied object identity quite a bit now. So how is object identity thought to be represented in IT populations of neurons? Inferotemporal cortex, I should say.
Yeah. So object identity is exactly one of those representations we think of as being a pattern of spikes coding scheme. So as we know, the way information gets into our brains, visual information, is through our eye. And so that's going to activate a wave of activity across our brain. So signals are going to propagate through these hierarchically arranged brain areas. So V1, V2, V4. And then eventually signals reach this brain area called inferotemporal cortex, or IT. And we think of IT as the highest stage of processing in the form processing pathway, meaning that after signals leave IT, they are combined with other sensory modalities. Mm-hmm. And so they go into association cortex. But within IT, we have a lot of reason to think that that brain area is supporting our ability to identify the objects that are out there in the world, and specifically to solve what is known as the invariance problem. So the fact that you can identify the same face or the same object as the same thing, despite different views you might see it in. So it might be from different positions or background contexts or different sizes as it moves closer to you on your retina. And within IT, different objects will evoke different patterns of spikes across the population for precisely the reason you said. Some neurons are more selective for particular objects than others. So some neurons might be more responsive to, say, a pencil and others to an apple. And so that's going to evoke a different pattern of spikes depending on the objects that are out there in view. And the way we like to think about that is in a representational space, which is very geometric, so it makes it very intuitive, where we can think about each axis in that space as the activity of a particular neuron. So if we're working in IT cortex, we have, say, a 16 million dimensional space we're working in. And the patterns of spikes in that are evoked across the IT population will correspond to a vector in that high dimensional space. And what we know about IT is when you look at different images that have the same content, like the same objects in them, what you get are clusters of these response vectors in similar locations of this high-dimensional space. So you can think about them, for example, as the population vector angle. Those are all going to be clustered together. And so that's how we think object identity is reflected.
So looking at a hot dog from, you know, up above, looking at it down on the table versus picking it up and looking at it on end before I take a delicious bite of it or something.
You got it. Yep.
Okay. So very, very good. So you have this vector angle in a, what'd you say, 16 million dimensional space?
Yeah.
Of course. Easy to visualize.
Easy. Yes. Very intuitive.
But then I brought up the old rate code idea because you found a different independent mechanism could underlie memorability in this same population of IT neurons. And I know it's not exactly the rate code that we're talking about, but it is the magnitude. And I'll, you know, how? I'll ask you just how.
How? So memorability refers to the fact that we systematically find some images easy to remember and others we find easier to forget. And so you can ask the question, well, what differs in the representation, in the visual representation of those easily memorable versus easily forgettable images? And so let's go back to our example of you have a bunch of different images of the same object. Let's say it's an elephant. Okay. And so it's an elephant in lots of different pictures, but some of those pictures are going to be super memorable pictures of that elephant and others are going to be less memorable. And so we went after this question and we found that the answer is remarkably simple and elegant. And that is, it's the overall magnitude of the response. So the identity is encoded in the pattern of spikes across the population or the angle in this high dimensional space, whereas the memorability is encoded in the numbers of spikes coming out of IT or the magnitude of this population response vector.
So one of the things
two complementary coding schemes.
Yeah, which is, so you wouldn't just at first blush think, well, this is going to be the same population of neurons that would encode both of these things. What made you think, we'll just look in the same area as object identity and see what we can pull out of it for memorability?
Yeah. I mean, for us, we're really driven by the behavior at first, right? So there's a behavior we're trying to explain, and so then we after the neural correlate that can account for that behavior. And so the historical trajectory there was that this fascinating field of image memorability, there's really beautiful work done there in human behavior and then in human fMRI. And it was really the work of Wilma Bainbridge working with Odoliva that pinpointed high-level visual cortex in humans as being the locus for image memorability. And so then the question was just, well, then how? So that's where we went in and looked for how. Yeah.
Well, so one of the first things, and you know, I'm kind of going off of two recently published papers in eLife here. And by the way, Travis Meyer, who is on both these papers, used to have an eLife office just a few doors down from me in the Carnegie Mellon.
Really?
The Mellon Travis Institute.
Oh, that's fantastic. I had no idea.
You should ask him if he remembers me, because he was a postdoc in Carl Olson's lab. And
yeah.
Maybe he'll remember. I beat Carl Olson in a ping pong match one Christmas, and that was a big deal. But I don't
bet
know.
He'll- Yeah.
Well, you've probably heard some Carl Olson stories. So.
Yes, I know Carl. He's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. You probably know Carl. Yeah.
He's Carl. One of the godfathers of IT Cortex. Yeah, for sure.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so one of the first things that you guys showed is that memorability could be related to what's a phenomenon known as repetition suppression in IT. So how does memorability relate to repetition suppression?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So what we've talked about so far is what differs in the visual representation of a more memorable versus a less memorable image. So how is when you see something for the first time, what happens in terms of its visual representation? But you can think about the question then, well, what happens next? So how is that more robust visual representation? How is that transformed into a more robust memory?
Right.
And so in order to answer that question, it's useful to first pinpoint that signal that drives your sense of remembering. So again, you're walking down the street, you see someone, you say, I know that person. Where is the signal in your brain that's driving that perceptive familiarity? And so we've been hunting around the brain trying to pinpoint that signal. And so we don't definitively know, but our working hypothesis now, which is supported by a considerable amount of evidence at this point, is that it is this, what the signal you referred to, repetition suppression in high-level visual brain areas like IT cortex and perirhinal cortex. And so what repetition suppression is it's a phenomenon we know exists. So it's an adaptation-like phenomenon where you get a really high firing rate response to a novel image, and then you get a decrement in the response the next time you see it, so when it's familiar. And the characteristics of this signal are remarkably well aligned with everything we know about visual memory behavior. Mm-hmm. So, for example, repetition suppression is extremely selective for images, even after you've seen many of them, hundreds or thousands of images. It's still very specific to the images you've seen. It lasts a very long time, even after you've seen an image only once. And it seems to disappear at the same rate at which we forget the images that we've seen. So they seem to be well aligned in many respects.
So the idea is you see, the elephant, or something, and your IT population of neurons fires and says, elephant. And then the next time you see the elephant, they say, elephant, a little quieter.
Exactly.
And that's the repetition suppression.
Yes. Yeah. That's what it looks like. And it is the case. So going back to the question, well, how does this more vigorous response to the first time you see something that's highly memorable, how's that transformed into a more robust memory? It is the case that that more vigorous response produces a larger magnitude decrement or more repetition suppression than a less memorable image.
Yeah.
So these are all consistent. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was kind of the first study that you guys published about this that we're talking about here. And this has to do with seeing the image the second time, right? And measuring how much suppression there is and correlating that with how memorable it is.
Yes.
But then this idea of the magnitude of firing being on first viewing of an image being related to how memorable it is sort of this, this what you guys explored in the second, more recent publication here.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how is memorability then related to, because I guess previous studies have not paid any attention to the actual rate, the actual magnitude of firing rates to decode things like object identity, right?
Yeah. So I was really surprised. It is the case that the field at large didn't really appreciate that there was a magnitude coding scheme associated within the class of natural images.
But if you're just trying to decode object identity, it doesn't really matter. And if that was kind
really
of the goal,
matter.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But you guys find that magnitude does indeed matter, and it matters for memorability, right?
Yes, exactly. So you could flip all of this on its head, and you could say what we've determined is that there's a previously unappreciated coding scheme that exists in IT where some images evoke higher population response magnitudes than others, and that this magnitude coding scheme does have consequences for cognitive processing downstream. For example, it influences how well you're going to remember an image. Yeah. And presumably it influences other things as well, not just memory, but other downstream processes.
Right. Well, that was kind of my next question. So, I mean, you can picture this, this vector, right, in a, let's say, a 3D Cartesian coordinate system, and it's got some angle where its population response points. And then it's pretty natural to then be able to imagine that arrow growing and shrinking. And the direction of the arrow can encode what object it is, and the growing and shrinking can encode how well you might remember it. But that's what I was going to ask, is what else is hiding in IT responses? Like, what else, is there room for other information in there?
What else is hiding in IT responses? It's a great question.
Not to cut off your thinking, but one of the reasons why I ask, and this is a terrible, terrible tangent because I have very, very unformed notions in my head, is IT all about object identity? Or I guess the bigger question is the ventral stream, is brain processing really about identifying the objects? Or is it, could it be about something else on a much more fundamental level? Is that a ridiculous question?
It is not a ridiculous question. And I think that while identifying the objects that are in view is a really important problem that has contributed tremendously to our understanding of processing in the ventral stream, I think that it has happened at the expense of appreciating that that's not just what your form processing pathway is for, is to identify objects invariant to all of the details, that the details matter too. And certainly the details matter for memory. So one of the classic behavioral signatures is we don't just remember the objects we've seen, but we remember a lot of detail about the configurations and contexts that we saw those objects in, and probably for a good reason, right? Yeah, so that's not, the ventral stream is not just doing invariant object processing. It's doing a lot of other stuff as well.
Yeah, obviously the world is not, I mean, except for magazines, and well, I guess these days pictures on computer screens, but the world is not made up of static images, obviously. But,
yeah.
But a lot of what is studied in the ventral stream and in IT is object categorization recognition of static images. And that's a lot of what is studied using convolutional neural networks, using these deep learning networks as well. And well, so you guys actually used, and you're part of the story of convolutional neural networks becoming this huge tool in neuroscience. And but you guys tested this hypothesis that, you know, these signals that you see in IT relate to memorability by testing it in these convolutional neural networks. And it's pretty interesting. Do you want to just describe how you tested it and what you found?
Yeah. So the question we were asking is, having identified population response magnitude as a strong correlate of memorability, we were interested in tracing that back to its origin. So you can ask the question, does this emerge from a system that's been wired up to see, or does it require that you constrain the system to also remember what it's seeing? So is it due to the optimizations required for visual processing or for memory? Mm-hmm. And so we started by just probing deep neural networks that have been trained to categorize objects. So as you, and I'm sure many of your listeners are probably aware of this really great literature by, say, Dan Yemins and Jim DiCarlo and Nico Kriegeskorte.
I've had Dan and Nico on the show, yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah, so that in that work, what they have done is they've trained deep nets, so convolutional neural networks and variants of that, to categorize objects. So just to take images and put tags on those images. Mm-hmm. And they train those computer models to perform object recognition. And then they compare different layers of those deep neural networks to representations in the brain. And they find some really non-trivial alignments between what's happening in the deep nets and what's happening in brains.
Yeah, I mean, the story is that convolutional neural nets provide the by far best account of the neural responses in brains.
And I would agree with that completely. Yes, for sure. So we asked the same question. Well, now let's just take those same deep nets that have been trained just to do object categorization. And I want to emphasize, these networks cannot remember anything. Yeah. They'll respond exactly the same way to the first time they see an image and the second time and the millionth time, right? These are once the training has been fixed, these are static processing machines. They also haven't been optimized to predict memorability in any way.
Right.
But those same networks naturally not only predicted the images that would be most memorable, but they did it via the same coding scheme that we found in the brain. So if you looked at higher layers of these networks, places that are analogous to infratemporal cortex, we found that those layers responded more vigorously with higher magnitude responses to some images over others. And those images that they responded the most vigorously to are the ones that we find most memorable,
yeah.
Remarkably.
It is remarkable, yeah.
It's remarkable. And I think it really, it's not just remarkable, it's insightful as well, because it tells us a lot about what this memorability phenomenon is and what it isn't. Mm. So, for example, you might speculate that the reason that certain images are more memorable is because they grab your attention. Or you might say the reason that it's more memorable is because it produced some sort of prediction error. I think, you know, insofar as if you wire up a system to categorize objects and it recapitulates this phenomenon, you might argue that whatever a system that's wired up to process objects does, we might call that sensory processing, and that these other phenomenon might be, you know, just kind of explained away, demystified in that sense, and that, you know, attention and predictive coding, you might argue, belong to other realms of explanation, not just this one, you know, for example.
Right.
So I think this is an example of CNNs making an important contribution of demystifying how the complexity of the brain works. And so I think that's what's been satisfying to me.
Well, I mean, it's satisfying. I mean, so, you know, CNNs, by and large, these days are still like feed forward only, and cognitive functions you were just talking about, like, you know, well, or reward prediction errors, attention, a lot of those things are thought of to be, can be top down processes, right?
Yes.
Recurrent neural networks cause all sorts of math trouble and interesting dynamics and very interesting possibilities. But yes. I mean, so what do you think? Is recurrent activity in networks, is that overhyped, or is it just useful for other things like top-down processing, or does it mean that vision and in this case memory or memorability is just less interesting or more fundamental, or what? What does it mean?
Yeah, no, these are all great questions. I mean, you know, one of the things that I find really striking about the signals that we've just been talking about. So we've talked about three different types of representations so far: object identity, memorability, and memory. Those three signals are actually staggered in time in IT cortex. Yeah. So strictly, a CNN can't account for that aspect of what the brain is actually doing. So what we see is if you present an image, you get a delay between the time that that image is presented and the time that the signals arrive in IT cortex. It's about 80 milliseconds. And it's only about 40 milliseconds later that you get information about memorability. So in that first feed-forward wave, you don't have any information about the images that are going to be the most versus the least memorable. That arrives about 40 milliseconds later.
I did not.
And at that point, you don't have any information about whether you've seen something before, yes or no. That arrives yet 40 milliseconds later still. So these things are, in fact, staggered in time. So the brain is certainly reflecting these signals, but reflecting them in a very dynamic way. And to really explain or recapitulate what the brain is doing, we're going to have to account for that recurrent processing as well.
But at first pass, you still see that the magnitude of the responses in your convolutional neural network do reflect the memorability in yes. these later IT-like stages, right?
And yes.
And like you said, I mean, it's remarkable that these were trained just to categorize objects, not to, you know, remember the objects. I mean, it would be trivial to train a ConvNet to on memorability, right? To just, you know, did have I seen it or not? That would be a trivial mm-hmm. matter. And
yes.
I imagine the artificial unit responses you'd see would be quite different.
Well, so that's there is a neural network that's remarkably good at predicting what images will be most memorable. It comes out of Ode Olive's group at MIT. It's called MemNet. And what they did is they started with a version of AlexNet that had been trained not only on objects but also scenes. And they found that was already a really good predictor of image memorability. But then they topped up its training to be even better. And MemNet does perform at the noise ceiling of like human memorability scores. So yeah. So you're right on both counts, right? That you get almost there with a deep net, and then you can get a little bit better by doing something else.
Oh, see, you'll learn, Nicole. I'm right on all accounts. You know, it's my podcast, so I get to
Excellent.
I wish that were the case.
So, surveyed a lot of the field, yeah.
So CNNs they're becoming really the standard way, almost to test neural hypotheses, since, like we mentioned, they match neural data better than any other model that's been tested, essentially. And like I said, you're part of this story of the rise of, you know, CNNs through like Jim DiCarlo's lab and others as a tool in neuroscience to understand perception, sensation. What, you know, what are your thoughts on sort of the state of CNNs as, are they a gold standard yet? Are they considered a gold standard?
Well, I mean, I think there's a strong argument to be made that their existence doesn't amount to understanding.
Yes.
Insofar as, you know, it's amazing now that we have computer models that recapitulate how the brain works to some extent.
To some extent,
I would argue
yes.
that it's, you know, they're doing a pretty good job at this point. But having a new thing that you don't understand, you could also argue, is not much more useful than having the first thing that you don't understand. Aside from the fact that presumably it should facilitate our ability to figure out how the CNNs work. And I would argue there's a lot of work to be done there,
yeah.
that this is a tractable problem that we should attack. And yeah, that's the next phase of research. It's going to help us understand how the visual system works. And we do not understand that. And having a CNN does not amount to understanding. We need to figure out how the CNNs work now.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna have Nico on again pretty soon. We'll go down that road a little bit. But your take then, are we anywhere near the limits of the usefulness of using these deep learning networks like CNNs to understand how brains work, or at least perception?
I mean, I think there's just really exciting work also to be done, you know, in broad strokes on using those as a front end to understand, you know, the even deeper parts of the brain, you know, executive function, memory, how do memory and perception interact with one another, right? So we want to take the CNNs and build on those to understand even, you know, more awesome processing beyond basic sensory perception, right?
You know, throw some other even more complicated neural networks that we won't understand on top of each other and see what we get. What's your general experience about how, like, neuroscientists? I know you run in a crowd that's probably very pro deep networks to understand brains and things like that. But I don't know, what's your experience about how neuroscientists feel about things like convolutional neural networks as models of visual perception? Are people skeptical?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's skepticism on different levels. I think, yeah, there are the hardcore, you know, deep netters that I wouldn't call myself a part of, who really, you know, argue that the existence of the deep nets themselves and the fact that recapitulate what the brain is doing amounts to understanding, right? That you have now the architecture, you have the optimization principles, you have the learning algorithm, that is understanding. I think there's that crowd. And that's a rare breed, but they definitely exist. And then there's the little bit more middle of the road. And I would include myself in that camp, who thinks like, wow, they're an awesome tool, but they're just another tool in the toolbox, right? You know, are they that much more useful than my electrodes or my behavior? No. I mean, it's just, you know, it's one of these tools that all together are going to help us solve this problem. I think it's pretty rare these days to encounter someone who is a complete skeptic and sees that they have no role whatsoever. But I think there are also good arguments that they could be vastly improved by making them more biologically realistic,
yeah,
for example, right? Yeah. And so I think Eero Simoncelli at NYU has some really beautiful examples of that. You know, you can recapitulate in a very deep net. You can recapitulate the same thing it's doing by a few shallow layers if you just include things like divisive normalization or gain control. So we might argue that that's like a more efficient shallow net is better or equal to a very deep net, you know.
Yeah. Since we're talking about convolutional neural networks, so there's this sort of ongoing tension between AI and neuroscience. I don't really want to call it a tension, but there's just different rates of progress, let's say, in the AI world, right? Where in archive, you have 10,000 papers every day coming out with a different tweak of a network and a different implementation and does different things. And then from the AI side, they probably expect, okay, now you in neuroscience, now test this. And it's just slower in neuroscience. Is this a problem or is it a opportunity? You know, how do you view these different sort of rates of AI and neuroscience progress? I mean, you're not tempted, like you don't like read an archive paper and think, oh, I've got to implement this tweak into my network to test it against my data, things like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think building systems, engineering is fundamentally different than, you know, neuroscience. I think that, doing experiments and collecting that whole arc from behavioral to neural data and doing sophisticated analyses on it. Right now, yeah, we're in a state in which it just takes a long time. I mean, we will spend more time analyzing our data than we'll spend collecting it, right? The bottleneck is not really even in the experiments. It's in the trying to wrap our heads and understand what's going on once we get the data on the hard drive.
Yeah, but experiments take a long time, so that's even sadder. Really, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're dealing with difficult problems. I mean, it's wonderful, you know, the new things that are happening in neuroscience to speed all this up. But really, they're not speeding it up. What they're doing is they're allowing us access to the data we always wanted to have, right? I would argue, like, right, we're getting massive data sets now, which is really exciting and is allowing us to do all sorts of things with it. Yeah, so it feels a little bit apples and oranges to me. I mean, I understand why engineering is moving at the rate it's doing, and I think they shouldn't slow down. They should, you know, keep doing that. But we can't keep up with that because there's just no way.
But there is, and sorry, this is kind of a large tangent, and we'll move on in a second. But, you know, so there is the engineering push, and that's to solve problems and make the world a better place. But there is still a core push in AI, at least from its origins, and I would argue still today, a core part of AI is understanding minds, is understanding intelligence in general. And they're not they. AI engineers, people who work solely with neural networks and categorizing things, doing speech recognition, they're not bound by the same questions of, is that actually how it works in brains, or can we make it work and then create this shiny new toy that then could be used as a model to understand how we think. Did I ask a question? I didn't even ask a question. I'm curious. So I think that's where the crux of the disparity in rates of progress comes in. I don't know. I think I'm just jealous of the AI world that they can just make models and run free, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The robots, it's going to work or it's not going to work. The algorithm works or it doesn't work, right? And if it does something interesting, then that's great, right? Yeah. I agree. There's something I think we're both having a hard time verbalizing in terms of just the difference in science versus engineering, the difference in building something versus trying to discover something. Yeah. I don't have good words for that either, right?
Maybe I'm trying to verbalize without denigrating anyone. So there you go.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll just call them different.
It's different. Yeah. More is different. So the idea of visual memory and image memorability and how it's reflected in brains leads into your recent ideas about how visual novelty could be used as a mechanism in brains and in machine learning, specifically reinforcement learning, for intrinsic reward, and which you detail in this current opinion of neurobiology piece, which is titled Visual Novelty, Curiosity, and Intrinsic Reward in Machine Learning and the Brain. Nicole, why do machines and or animals need to encode novelty?
Yeah, so this is an example of myself and my group getting a lot of inspiration from what's been happening in AI and machine learning. And so asking ourselves, just taking a step back and asking ourselves, we initially started the investigation of visual memory just motivated by the fact that we're amazing at remembering the images that we've seen. And that in and of itself, it was just a behavior we wanted to explain. But you might want to take even a step further back and ask yourself, well, what do we do with that amazing ability to remember images? Like, what's it for? What do we use it for? And there, I think machine learning has some really interesting things to say that build on some observations that I think are classic observations. And that is, if you have a really effective memory system that can report to you what you've seen before, the flip side of that is you also have a really good novelty indicator that tells you what you have not seen. And that novelty or the preference for looking at or being attracted to novelty, you might call that curiosity, is a really effective way to drive efficient exploration for learning. So imagine, for example, you're a baby, you're trying to learn about the world. Instead of just looking randomly about your world and encountering half the time things you've seen before and the other half the time things that are new to you, you might want to preferentially explore the things that you have not seen. It's a more efficient way to learn. And that is, in fact, exactly what babies do. So babies will preferentially view things that are new to them. It's a behavior that we see ubiquitously across all animals and it's been documented for over 100 different species, including turtles and dolphins and sheep and monkeys and everything else. So in machine learning, the way that this has been formalized is by building on classic reinforcement learning. So the way classic reinforcement learning works is it's completely reward driven. So the value, so when trying to decide between two different options, things to explore, the value of those different options is computed based on the amount of reward that's anticipated to be associated with each of them. And so you're going to choose the more valuable option, the one that gives you more reward. Now, this type of classic reinforcement learning has been hugely effective and very insightful in figuring out how biological creatures and machines might and can learn. But it's also known to be ineffective in certain situations. For example, when almost everything is new and you don't know anything about the world, or when rewards are very sparse. So it's really hard to drive and drive a system to learn that way. What's been going on in reinforcement learning is extensions of classic reinforcement learning to incorporate novelty considerations. So now computing value, not just based on how much reward a particular option is anticipated to give you, but a combination of reward and the intrinsically valuable experience of novelty or curiosity. And so by combining those two things and different weighted contributions, you can drive an agent to learn. For example, an artificial agent to learn how to play an Atari video game. And under a bunch of different scenarios, it's a more effective way to drive the exploration required for learning.
Or to get a human to not drop out of grad school, but continue forward. And
yes, when rewards are sparse and everything is new. Exactly. Exactly. Curiosity. Yeah.
Must be intrinsically motivated. Yeah. So it's pretty straightforward, like you said, how to encourage exploration or curiosity. I mean, you have this reward function that an algorithm maximizes in reinforcement learning, and you just add novelty as an extra reward term in the equation.
Yep.
Balanced by some bells and whistles that you mentioned.
Yep.
But to do that, the agent actually needs to know if something is novel or whether it's been in this particular state before. And at first blush, it seems easy to do, right? It seems easy for like an agent, especially an artificial agent, to keep track of states just by counting. So, you know, for example, you know, if it's been at the annual SFN conference before, the agent would know, ah, this is neither novel nor good. I should do something else, it would think, right? But it's not, it's my dig at SFN, but it's not so simple.
SFN is not simple, no.
Right. Keeping track of things is not simple either. SFN is not simple either. But you point out there are hurdles to overcome for the agent to really know if, you know, if it's revisiting the same state or if it's in a novel state. So what are those hurdles and how can reinforcement learning algorithms overcome them?
Yeah, so the hurdles have strong analogies to the sorts of things that have been tackled for solving the problems of visual object recognition, and they are the host of invariance problems. Yeah. So, for example, in order for an artificial agent who receives pixels on a video screen as input to convert that into some estimate of whether or not a particular state or location in the video game has been visited before, they have to solve the problem, which is often referred to as view invariance. So they have to appreciate that different pixel patterns can correspond to the same state or the same location in the game. Another type of invariance that's incorporated into these machine learning algorithms is what we might call state invariance. And so this is an appreciation that there might be kinds of states that might have similar characteristics. And that, so for you might imagine that all hallways that are green lead to dead ends. And so if you see another green hallway, it's not worth exploring, but a red hallway might be, even if you haven't been down that particular green hallway before. So that's state invariance. And so, yeah, so the way that these systems deal with this issue is they train up typically deep neural networks to solve these two types of invariance and problems and then order to compute the novelty of a particular state or option that's before them.
I guess these are called pseudo counts is a name given.
Yeah. Yeah, so the first generation really was a count-based approach, which really counted the number of times a state or a type of state had been visited. And so the new generation performs pseudo-count type operations. And the difference and the advantage of pseudo-counts over counts are that pseudo-counts are probabilistic estimates of the, you know, the probability that that is a novel option before you based on everything you've experienced up to this point. And that allows for and facilitates generalization to new things that are similar to the things you've experienced, right? So it's not a binary, have I seen this, yes or no, but rather it's a continuous estimate of novelty.
And so, okay, so we start off the show by talking about how memorability could be encoded in brains, and that includes novelty, essentially, because the more novel something is, the more you're going to remember it. And now we're talking about novelty and in these mechanisms in machines and using pseudo counts. Is there a way to compare these two things? I mean, so it's your contention that we can bring these two ideas together and learn something and move forward. How's that?
Yeah, no, I mean, so yeah, so I mean, we're very inspired by, again, going back to like the foundational question, we're amazing at remembering the images that we've seen. We're amazing at detecting things that are novel. What do we use that for? Perhaps we're using that for the learning required to guide exploration. Can that give us any insight into how novelty and familiarity are encoded in IT cortex? Like, why do they have the properties that they do? And what we do see is, you know, a lot of inspiration and things that make us rethink how IT cortex is operating. So, for example, we also see like these pseudo count like approaches. We see somewhat unsurprisingly continuous estimates of novelty as opposed to discrete ones in the brain. Right. So IT cortex signals not only whether something is novel or familiar, but for example, recency. So how recently you've seen something before. So if you've just seen it, you get this really strong familiarity signal. And if you it's been a long time, then that signal weakens. We also have representations in IT cortex of individual neurons aren't themselves invariant detectors of object identity, but it's really the population as a whole by which you get this object identity-based representation. And we see in IT cortex also that the novelty signal is not an invariant novelty signal for object identity, but rather there's a lot of information that's rich about the particular images that you've seen. So if you saw an object in a particular configuration or context, IT cortex also signals that. And that's the thing that we can begin to link to some of the machine learning type approaches, where you can imagine if an agent's playing a video game, it's not really effective to have a novel object detector, right? That's not really going to help you learn how to play an Atari video game, right? Because it's not that apples are associated with states, right? You know? So, but it's more scene-based. It's more, more of a holistic account of, you know, have you been at this state before? But it's also, and it's important to say that in IT cortex, we also see generalization across, for example, views. So you do see to some extent that different views of the same object, you will get some generalization of this novelty signal, but you'll still have information about whether you saw that exact pixel pattern before, right? So IT cortex seems to be doing lots of different things in complicated ways. And this work helps us understand or conceptualize what it might be doing.
Yeah. This, I mean, this goes back to my thought about, you know, my question of whether object recognition is what IT is doing, right? Because it's always doing it in the service of something. And whether whether object recognition could actually just fall out of whatever it's doing in the service of whatever it's doing. This actually reminds me of Tanya Conkle's work too, whom I had on the show, and the looking at the visual stream orthogonally. And basically, you know, she showed that objects can be are grouped in the brain based on whether they're small or large or animate. And this kind of maps onto, you know,
I
whether
love this work. It's fantastic. Yes, her work is absolutely fantastic.
It's, yeah, it's fun. But it, and it's all based on, you know, then essentially what the thing that you're categorizing is actually useful for, right?
Yes.
Navigation or eating or, you know, whatever, running from or handling in your hand. And and that way of looking at it is, well, it's an orthogonal way, essentially, of looking at it, where the object categorization recognition then almost kind of falls out of the purpose of the thing, that the process that you're, I mean, I'm just using all sorts of words here that don't mean anything, but so, yeah, I'm wondering how, you know, how you view then the role of IT within that realm of, you know, is the core thing that it's doing object recognition, or is it helping animals behave and object recognition falls out of that? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, we could frame the question a couple different ways. We could ask, what are the optimization principles by which, you know, evolution tried to wire up the visual system? One piece of work that I find really interesting and insightful is the recent work of Dan Yaman's group at Stanford, who's been taking on the problem of how is the visual system actually wired up? So as compelling as all of the deep net stuff is, we also know that it's highly non-biologically realistic insofar as it requires millions and millions of labeled examples, right? So here's a picture of a ball, you label with ball. Here's a picture of pencil, it's labeled pencil. And we know that there's no way that a baby is going to experience that many labeled examples in their lifetime.
Their
parents are going to give them a few. Yeah, exactly. But they're not going to give them millions. And so there's been an idea floating around for a while that the visual system might be wired up via some form of unsupervised learning, but nobody's really figured out how to get that to work robustly. And that's where Dan Yaman and his group have made some really important progress by optimizing a deep net to wire itself up via unsupervised learning through a process that they call local aggregation. And we don't have to get into the weeds of the details, but basically it's a clustering algorithm. And what I find really compelling about it is not only, one, does it work? So this network performs really well at classic state-of-the-art computer benchmarks. It also wires up a system that bears as much resemblance to the visual system as any other network wired up via backprop does. But this algorithm also relies on having something like a familiarity memory bank. So it does store memories of what it's seen so far in the process of forming these aggregates and these clusters. So to flip all of this on its head and to answer your question in a very indirect way, one might postulate that what the visual system is actually doing in the process of visual development is implementing some sort of form of local aggregation that incorporates memories of the things that it's seen. And what emerges from that are the properties of the visual system that include clustering for objects of different identities, but also relies on memories, and naturally what emerges is memorability. So it starts to tie all of these things together in compelling ways that I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface of understanding. But I think you're onto something, that all of this is really related to one another, and it's not about labeled examples and optimizing for object recognition. There's something else going on there that's really important.
Even if that something else is more fundamental or core, it's still really impressive that you can train a deep net on object categorization and then have things like memorability fall out of that, which is pretty interesting.
Agreed. And a huge contribution that we can do that now, right? That's an amazing development since I got into this field 15 years ago, you know, into object recognition specifically, right? It's a wonderful, wonderful development.
Yeah, we can all agree on that. When you were describing that work that Dan is pursuing, you used the term familiarity again. And, you know, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that AI agents are also limited by essentially the same resources that our brains are limited by, although the limit is much higher, right? And so it's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that an AI agent would need familiarity over just perfect recollection. Like, why would why would an AI agent not recall perfectly? Why wouldn't you build that into an AI agent?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that. I don't know. Certainly, you know, you emphasize that it must be the case that having this low bit familiarity tag, if what you're trying to extract is novelty, having that low bit information is a very efficient way to store novelty. It's going to be a very fast way to recover novelty. And it's going to be a really good way to do it if you have efficiency constraints or you're limited in your resources. Whether or not AI is going to need it or not, I think, you know, the question is, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know whether that's going to be true or not. Yeah.
I just had Tom Griffiths on the show, and he uses this resource rationality framework to investigate these sorts of things. And one of his ideas is that if you build a system with limited resources, like we are limited, the efficiency with which we work and the, you know, the limits that we have, you might actually then get some sort of generality that we have. And it's really unknown, like, what you would get if you just lifted the top off of all of the resources, like what would fall out of it. And so, so our limits could actually constrain the constraints of imposed by our limits could actually, you know, lead us to this generality. But Anyway, so mm-hmm. all yeah. of this is tied together. It's beautiful stuff. Well, so Nicole, yeah. So you know, this is kind of a review and in the current opinion in neurobiology, are you guys pushing forward with it? What's going on?
So we're trying to think about like what's the right experiment to do, right? So yeah. minimally, we would love to have a behavioral paradigm where we can actually trade off, for example, the intrinsically valuable experience of novelty with external rewards, right? And so in order to trade those two things off. So how do you quantify that behaviorally, how valuable novelty is? And then we're interested in where novelty and reward are integrated in the brain. And there's a good reason to think that's probably the same place that's housing representations of novelty, perirhinal cortex. Mm-hmm. So it's vastly underappreciated that perirhinal cortex receives this giant dopaminergic input that those of us who work in perirhinal cortex kind of whisper about, but nobody really understands very well. And so I think it's very likely the case that the same place that is storing representations of the things that we've seen is also integrating that information with external rewards in order to compute a holistic estimate of the value of a stimulus. Oh, so that's my pet hypothesis right now. And so that's a hypothesis that we're starting to figure out and ask ourselves, how could we test that?
That's great. Do you guys whisper about it because you don't want other people to jump in and compete? Or do you whisper about it because it's unknown?
it's more just like, it's so giant. What's it doing? What do you think it's doing, yeah. right? You know, yeah. I think it's more of a whisper along those lines. It's just trying to get ideas from one another. Have you ever observed anything? You know, like, what have you seen? Yeah, how could we go about this? It's more of that.
That's cool. You don't often think of, so there are hot areas in the brain, right? They become, you know, like right now, like grid cells in hippocampus. It's you win a Nobel Prize and then everybody just follows suit and studies those. And that's the key to the brain, you know. So, but the uncharted territory is running out in the brain, right? So it's cool that there are still plenty of areas that it's really uncharacterized, unknown.
That is true. There are still plenty of areas in the medial temporal lobe, perirhinal cortex, parahippocampal cortex. I agree. Entorhinal cortex and the hippocampus are starting to be less sparsely populated. Yeah, there are still places. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is great, Nicole. I wish you luck moving forward here. And do you mind if I open it up to sort of more general questions?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, happy to.
Do you have like some sort of neuroscience, something that's known in neuroscience that you think would benefit AI that is not currently being appreciated in the AI world, or it's being appreciated but maybe used the wrong way or something like that?
The one example that comes to mind is an example about future predictive coding. Mm. So there's a lot of really great work in AI going on right now in terms of predictive coding, and namely in the realm of, for example, LSTMs. So what we know about predictive coding is that in order to predict what will happen next, which is a fundamentally important problem, you have to have some understanding of the statistical structure of the world, right? What things follow what other things, what's correlated with what. And you also have to have a memory of what's happened recently that you can then extrapolate on into the future. And so I think that in AI, those memories of recent history have typically had analogs to what's going on in terms of persistent recurrent circuitry in the brain. So that's kind of an activated working memory. One of the things that I've been very compelled by is the work about future predictive coding in the retina, which uses a fundamentally different type of circuit in order to store memories of recent history that then can be extrapolated. And the types of computations in terms of future predictions that happen in the retina are really important. For example, when you're trying to catch a ball, your brain has to do something called lag compensation. So if you just do the delay between the visual world and the latency of the activation of your retina, if you put your arm out at where you see the ball where your retina is activated at any one point in time, you're going to miss it by meters. Mm. If a ball is moving, say, at 100 kilometers an hour. So your brain has to fix this. And we think that the retina does some work to fix this. And one of the ways it does future visual prediction is by simple feed-forward adaptation. As opposed to a, so that's how it stores memories of what's happened recently. And stacks of that very simple feed-forward computation have proven to be really valuable for predicting future events, at least under some circumstances. I've never seen this type of thing employed in AI. Maybe I'm wrong, but usually future predictive computation in AI, it's much more complicated than that. It involves something like an LSTM or a very a much more complicated piece of machinery than that. Yeah. So an example, simple computations, really powerful output.
You're all about this, you know, adaptation, habituation, repetition suppression. I mean, this could be how we encode time as well, for instance. That's interesting. Really simple mechanisms. Like I said, you've had this, you know, career in visual neuroscience, but things change. You know, I remember how naive I was going in to, you know, graduate school and even just as a technician before that. Is there something that you can think of that you've changed your mind about through your career?
I think the biggest changes of mind, I mean, aside from, you know, just being completely exposed to new questions I didn't even know existed, the biggest changes, the most fundamental changes across my career have been just the appreciation for how rewarding and how challenging being a good mentor is.
Oh, yeah.
So I did not appreciate that when I was a mentee.
You probably appreciated how poorly it could be performed at sometimes.
I had such great experiences with my mentors. I look back and I just feel so fortunate.
And you didn't know how good you had it, huh?
And I now can appreciate what a challenge it is, but also how rewarding it is to invest in it. And you know, if you can take good people and help facilitate the bringing the best out of them, but it's a huge responsibility. You know, when you have a mentee, there's a big responsibility on your shoulders, right? To minimally don't screw them up, right? I mean, but you know, ideally bring out the best in them, right? And that means it's challenging insofar as there is no one right mentoring style. Every mentee is a unique individual who has a unique set of needs, right? And so it's something I did not appreciate its depth and breadth when I was younger.
Who's one example of a mentee that you've really screwed up? No, I'm just kidding. So I made the joke earlier about we were talking about, you know, the scant external rewards that you get when you're in graduate school. As a faculty member, since I opted out and never got there, right, people have to keep their eyes on the prize and become a faculty member and tenure and all that stuff. Are the external rewards more frequent as a faculty member, you know, with the mentoring, and or is it even less frequent? And there's a bias here because to get to where you are, you have to be highly intrinsically motivated anyway and not give a damn so much about external rewards.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm trying to very succinctly answer your questions because it's really, it's a very big space. So on one hand, insofar as science is about big gains, and, you know, but we set a high bar, so many rejections.
The grand of the vision.
You're going to experience more gains, but more rejections as well, right? And so there's some asymmetry there, so you better be able to take it. So it's just more of that stuff. So on one hand, because you get to be involved in so many different projects, right? It's hopeful that at least something's working at any one time, right? So you're not going to suffer that same hit as you suffer when you're a graduate student or a postdoc. And, you know, if you have one thing going on and it's going well or it's not going, you know, and so you have to be really resilient to the downs to see your way up to the ups. When you're a faculty member, you know, there is some benefit to hopefully something's working at any one time. So if not everything is working, you got something you can point to. At the same time, there's a lot of some things that aren't working. There are a lot of rejections and things, right? You know, so you do have to like keep your eye on the, it's all going to be good in the end.
Yeah. In some sense, I think one of the most valuable things that I took away from graduate school, and graduate school is not the only, you know, venue, because there's postdoc and, you know, multiple postdocs, et cetera, is just not celebrating, being able to celebrate failure, but really being able to take it and move forward. And I think it's such a valuable skill to learn, if you can call it a skill.
For sure. Yeah. That resilience, that ability to celebrate the successes of, for example, submitting a paper. That's one of my favorite times to celebrate. Like if we can get to the stage that we think, you know, that we've completed the project, let's celebrate that moment, right? After that, it's a little bit out of our hands. There's a lot of noise in the system. It's going to be a tough road, but let's celebrate that moment. And then let's have each other's backs on all the moments going forward. And then there's, of course, the big celebration at the end, right? When the world gets to see it.
Yeah. Oh, in my case, that end celebration, when it drags on for 2.5, 3 years, though, it's hard to...
It is hard.
A lot of people I've had on the show have said that math is the most important skill to learn for someone wanting to get into neuroscience and AI. Do you agree with that? And if so, I mean, linear algebra is the one that everyone says, you know, points to being the most important. But, you know, what do you see as the most important skill, if whether it's math or not?
Yeah, I mean, I would rephrase it a little bit, and I wouldn't say math. I would say quantitative training.
Okay.
Which comes, I think there's an arm that's mathematical, but there's another arm that's more engineering based, and then there's another arm that's scientific based.
At least it has applications then.
It has applications. I think that somebody can be exquisitely trained in math and incapable of dealing with the complexities and the messiness of brain and engineering. There's a beauty and an elegance to math. It's so clean. There's a closed form solution in the limit of infinite data when you have a spherical cow, that sort of thing, right? That I don't think that it's not that alone. It's the most important thing is a quantitative foundation that allows you to have the self-confidence to acquire the new skills you're going to need going forward, and even develop those new skills when you realize they don't exist. Develop new quantitative tools, new ways of data analysis, new engineering things, right? It's really the self-reliance and the self-confidence that you can do that, and just that basis that allows you to do that. But again, these three arms, math, engineering, programming, big data, data analyses. It's all of these things, I think, together that are the important things to kind of cross-train in.
It's interesting to me that no one has just blanket said coding, because it's such an important skill nowadays. Like when the coding became important while I was in graduate school, I feel like, across the neurosciences. And now it's super important.
Yeah, I mean, I'm highly involved in undergraduate education. And we talk about the difference between computer science and data science, right? Mm-hmm. Those are actually two different things. Like you can code, but still not know what to be able to, you know, when you have a big data set, not know what to do with it, right? So there's a distinction between those two things for sure.
Well, if you were just starting out in undergrad and you were in undergrad and thinking about your next steps or something, and you took away all of the knowledge that you have now, well, it doesn't matter if you take it away. What would you go into?
One of the most exciting developments I've seen is an increased appreciation in the STEM fields of making early STEM education kind of universally interesting. So I experienced that when I started. So I started in chemical engineering, and I experienced that early, what I saw as kind of an obsession. It was with, I think, combustion rates of different materials that might be used for fuel. And I bailed and I went into microbiology and biochemistry because they seem to be studying interesting problems.
Oh, that's why I got out of mechanical engineering, sort of because they had like a materials push. And I was like, what are you doing?
Exactly, right? And so I think STEM has really started to rethink education in an important way. And if I look back on my education, it was interesting, but it was very fact-based. And I think it wasn't enough problem-oriented. So if I had to do it again, I think I would stick with engineering, but I would hope that I would be in an era that now appreciates that engineering should be interesting beyond just combustion rates or material properties, right? It should be more broadly interesting to the students who are interested in those fields.
Yeah. And this is sort of seeing the forest for the trees too, and it's almost impossible to know when you've never seen a forest, right? Like what, and all of a sudden they're throwing trees at you.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a terrible metaphor, but
I hear you though. Yeah.
Yeah. In the same vein, there's a right balance, and I don't know what it is. This is why I'm asking you. What is the right balance between having a singular focus going way down the road in a very narrow topic and becoming a super expert in that very narrow topic versus keeping a broad picture and studying neighboring fields that don't necessarily have exactly to do with what you're studying?
Yeah, so I don't think there's a universal answer for this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that science benefits by having such a diversity of personalities when it comes to this question, right? You know, in science, we need those pioneers who are going to take on problems that nobody's even thought of before, and they're just going to like plow ahead. And then we need others who are going to come and like really dig in and spend their entire career like flushing out the answers to a problem. You can imagine that first generation, you know, they need lots of breadth. They need to be really open and have like lots of knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you know, very global. Whereas that person who's really going to dig in and those people are really important too, but maybe they don't need such incredible breadth. I think we also have these really great individuals who have a particular tool.
Yeah.
And then they apply their tool to lots of different problems. Again, they need the breadth to be able to acquire the expertise to use their tool and apply it. But they are experts at one thing. So I don't think there's one right answer to any of this. And I'm just so happy that there isn't a prescription, because I think science would suffer if we didn't have
it accommodates
diversity
everyone.
Of different types. Yeah, yeah. We wouldn't progress at the same rate.
You know, when I think back to when I remember reading Patricia Churchland's neurophilosophy book in a laundromat when I was in college. This is when I was in mechanical engineering, and you have this vision. Okay, like I'm going to go and I'm going to study this. I'm going to become an expert neuroscientist. Now I have a PhD in neuroscience. And I don't know, I still feel naive in many ways, right? But do you feel like an expert? You are obviously an expert. Do you feel like an expert?
Do I feel like an expert? Yeah, I remember I had a similar experience like that. I remember telling my father at some point, I think it was in high school, I want to get a PhD so I know everything about something.
Everything, yeah.
And my dad just looked up from his paper and said, "No, you won't." And he started reading his paper again.
No, you won't what? Get the PhD?
You won't know everything about anything, right? You know, like he had the wisdom to know that, like that's what he meant.
Yeah.
Do I feel like I know everything about something? Absolutely not. But that's what really inspires me and drives me is this. If I spend too much time on any one problem, I tend to get a little bit bored. And so the fact that I can use my expertise to dream up, you know, new things I want to work on allows me to stay really engaged and excited in this field. So yeah. I'm happy that I don't know everything about anything, because that would be a very boring place to be.
My favorite part is the creation, the naivete. Fortunately for me, I'm a very naive person in many ways, so I can always maintain that level of interest in everything because I just somehow stay naive. It's something to do with my brain. I'm not sure, but
I like that. Yes, it is. It is the childlike curiosity, right, that drives efficient exploration for learning.
There you go.
You've got.
Well, I appreciate your time. I can feel the gratitude that you have looking back and wanting to impart this on your mentees and stuff, which I so much appreciate. And much luck moving forward, Nicole. My last question here, because I received an email from you and we're in different time zones, but I think that it was really early in the morning. My question is, what time do you wake up? And I'm wondering if I beat you in this regard.
Yes. So I do have a toddler in the house who likes to wake up early. And so, yeah, typically that is around, it's around 5:30.
Okay.
That we get up in the morning.
Beat you. You know what happens? Is this your only child? First child?
No, it's the second.
Oh, yeah. Second. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, so I have two and, the youngest one is... This is fascinating for listeners, right? The youngest one is almost five now, but I get up at 4:30 because that's the only time no one needs anything from me. Because as soon as they wake up, it's all done. And then, of course,
there's a headspace there. Yeah.
Past 6 p.m., I'm mush anyway, so.
For sure. Well, thank you, Paul. This has been a tremendous amount of fun, and I'm a huge fan of the podcast. And thank you for doing it. I mean, authentically, like I really enjoy listening. I enjoy the people that you've sampled. It's been just a ton of fun talking to you. It's been really enjoyable. So thank you.
Oh, thanks, Nicole. Brain Inspired is a production of me. And you. You can support the show through Patreon for a microscopic $2 or $4 per month. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help sustain and improve the show and prohibit any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thanks for your support. See you next time. Man.